Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Shri Krishna Sandarbha Adhyayana 3, Adhikarana 4, Adhyayana Summary, page 61. Thus, the current Adhyayana thoroughly refuted all the contrary ideas about the transcendental form of the Lord and established the human-like form of Krishna as the Supreme Brahman. First, the glories of Krishna's transcendental names are discussed, or it is proven that out of all the names of Krishna, the name of Krishna is the most powerful because it can be so prema upon the chanter. Then the supremacy of his form is affirmed by citing from various scriptures which state that meditating on the form of Krishna is the highest form of all meditations. Next, Krishna's vyuha forms are elucidated in order to prove that Krishna is superior to the Lord of Vaikuntha. And his appearance in the material world doesn't minimize his position as Swayam Bhagavan. After this, it is explained that all the other forms, amshas and avatars, enter Krishna when he appears to perform his pastimes on earth. This clarifies the statements of various scriptures which apparently describe Krishna as an amsha of other avatars such as Kiradaksha, Vishnu, Upendra, etc. Finally, the eternality of Krishna's form is asserted by scriptural statements. Refute the misconceptions of various impersonalist schools on the form of Bhagavan. The Adhyaya is concluded by proving the human-like form of Krishna is the most secret of all forms, and his worship is the topmost of all kinds of worship. Having cleared all the doubts and misconceptions about Krishna's form, and thus reaffirmed his supreme position as Swayam Bhagavan, the unique glory of his abode and his associates, which is described in the rest of the Sandarbha, could easily be understood, right? If you appreciate Krishna's position, then you're naturally going to appreciate all his associates and the Dham and everything. Since his position is the highest, then naturally all the Dham and his associates will be the highest, his pastimes, everything. So then you don't have to establish them. Once you've established Krishna, they're connected to Krishna, so therefore now they'll go on in the same glory. Yeah. Vriti. Having thus established the transcendental glory of the name and supremacy of the two-handed form of Krishna, the author next elucidates the special position of his abode and his associates. Okay. Krishna Sandarbha, the transcendental glory of Krishna's abode and devotees. Anuchedas 106 to 151. Okay, so this is just one adhyaya.
Yes.
Okay, so this is a big adhyaya.
One.
Oh. Yeah, we have about another 15 or something like that. And this is not so big like that. We have other ones that big.
What's
not
big?
Huh?
Why is it big?
Could be almost the same. The next one
will be about the same. It'll be two adhyayas.
Okay.
So we have this much and this much more.
Basically, this adhyaya establishes the eternality of the Lord's abode and his associates. Then a question arises about, if everything is eternal, then why he has to come and then move from one place to another? Like we see that Krishna moves from
Mathura
to Dwaraka. And also then if he is Swayam Bhagavan, then why the demigods don't go to him but goes to Narayan? In order to explain that, then the Prakat and Aprakat Leela is explained.
Okay. That's in the next adhyaya. Okay. Well, I mean, it's just like the big man. You go to the big man, you go to all these other people, you know.
And also, yeah. Only when his Prakat Leela is happening, then you can, everybody has access. Aprakat Leela only is
the associates. Okay. Adhyaya 4, the transcendental glory of Krishna's abode and his devotees, Anuchedas 106 to 151. Adhyaya Prakashika. Having elaborately described the supremacy and unique glory of Krishna's form in the previous adhyaya, the current adhyaya enunciates the glories of his pastime, places, and his associates whom he personally offers protection. First, the author, Srila Jiva Goswami, reiterates the eternality of the two-handed and the four-handed forms of Krishna by pointing out the flaws of the materialistic perception of the appearance and disappearance of the Lord. Then the author describes the glories of the eternal abode of Goloka, where the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, performs various charming pastimes along with his eternal associates. Goloka is the acme of all the spiritual planets, and is full of splendor and beyond the borders of all other regions, including Vaikuntha. That supreme abode manifests on earth for assisting the Supreme Lord in performing enchanting pastimes to please his devotees and attract all the conditioned souls to his lotus feet. Thus, there is practically no difference between Gokula manifested on earth and Goloka, save that this... So it means it's saved that this, what exists in that, is that what you're saying? That's the phrase.
Yes, Maharaj.
That is, save that this.
This phrase I took it from.
Yeah, then just put a comma. Then you know that it's that. That's phrase. You don't know it, then you know it's not going. Save that this means now you're going to enunciate. What exists in the shape of Goloka in the upper region is the same as Gokula in the mundane plane, when Krishna showed his various activity there. After this, the eternality and supremely glorious position of the associates of Krishna in Gokula, Goloka, is explained. The eternal associates of Krishna are a manifestation of his Swarupa, and thus possess qualities similar to him. Their appearance and disappearance in the material world happens by the will of Krishna, and because they are very dear to him, they could never be separated from him. Thus the associates of Krishna possess eternal forms which are equal in quality with him. Hence, the adhyaya established the supreme glory of Goloka, the eternal pastimes, places of Lord Krishna, as well as its eternal inhabitants, who possess great affection and are completely surrendered to Krishna. Overview of Adhikarnas. Adhikarna 1, Anuchedas 106 to 116, description of Goloka, the eternal abode of Krishna. Adhikarna 2, Anuchedas 117 to 152, the glories of the eternal associates of Krishna. This is the 152, and then it says 151.
152 Maharaj.
Oh, so the up is 152. Here it says also 152. Okay. 152. See, we got an extra on the sheet. Adhikarna 1, description of Goloka, the eternal abode of Krishna, Anuchedas 106 to 116. Adhikarna Prakashika. Having proven the supremacy of Krishna's form, the current Adhikarna describes the unique position of the places where his pastimes take place. First, the author reiterates that both the two-handed and the four-handed forms of Krishna are eternal and worship of the two-handed form is the topmost of all worships. The author also asserts that the Lord doesn't give up his transcendental form, but only withdraws it when he disappears from the world. Thus the form seen by the demons is made of Maya, and not a part of his Sarup. Such material forms are temporarily shown to the Asuras only, and when such exhibitions are withdrawn, the Asuras think that the Lord is no more existent, just as the foolish audience thinks the magician to be burnt to ashes or cut to pieces. The conclusion is that the Lord has no material body, and therefore is never to be slain or changed by his transcendental body. Or changed by his transcendental body? Means his transcendental body won't change him? Or you mean that the transcendental body never changes?
No, it changes.
He is never to be slain, I guess, or as is never changes or something. He has no material body. Yeah, something. Following this, the author explains that the transcendental abode of Krishna, called Goloka, is eternal and the topmost planet in the spiritual sky. This Goloka consists of three abodes, namely Dwarka, Mathura, and Vrindavan, or Gokula. Right, so this Gokula in here, is when you're talking about Goloka, it means the Vrindavan, means Braja. And then it also, then that same Vrindavan, when it comes down to earth, is called, known as Gokula, right? Or Boma Lila, Boma Vrindavan, like that. So it's the same place. So someone may say, oh, but that's Gokula and this is Gokula. It's the same place, so it doesn't matter if the name's used like that. Brahma Samhita demonstrates that the abode of Gokula is the topmost place in the cosmos and is in the shape of a lotus, with the central whirl having a hexagonal form containing the Kama Bija and Gopal mantra, surrounded by the petals of the abodes of different gopis. This Gokula is surrounded by an astonishing square area called Swetadweep, or Goloka, which is divided into four parts, which are the abodes of the four Vishnu forms, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Aniruddha, and Pradyumna. The statements of Brahma Samhita are affirmed by citing from different Upanishads and Puranas, which eulogize Goloka as the most sacred place and the topmost abode of the Supreme Lord. Having established the supremacy of Krishna's abode, the author then proves that the places of Dwarka, Mathura, and Gokula manifested on earth are eternal, and these abodes are non-different from the Goloka and manifested in the spiritual sky. This is proven by citing from the 10th canto of Bhagavatam, where the people of Braja, headed by Nanda Maharaj, are transported into the transcendental abode of Goloka, where they envision the form of Supreme Brahman, Krishna, in human form. Because of this, they become filled with the highest bliss and become astonished, since he alone is complete and appeared as their son. In this regard, Srila Prabhupada expresses the following in Chaitanya Charitamrita. The above-mentioned tamas, Dwarka, Mathura, and Vrindavan, are movable by the omnipotent will of Lord Krishna. When Sri Krishna appears on the face of the earth, he can also make his dhammas appear without changing their original structure. One should not discriminate between the dhammas on the earth and those in the spiritual sky, thinking that those in the earth to be material and the original boats to be spiritual. All of them are spiritual. Only for us who cannot experience anything beyond matter in our present conditioned state do the dhammas and the Lord himself in his archa form appear before us resembling matter to give us the facility to see spirit with material eyes. Thus the Adhikarana comprehensively describes the glories of Goloka, the acme of the spiritual sky. Anucheta 106, Riti. The author first concludes the discussion on the eternality of Krishna's form by establishing that his transcendental form is not contaminated by the modes due to his appearance in this material world and is not destroyed when he disappears from the world. He manifests himself in his original two-handed form when he desires to perform pastimes with his devotees and unmanifests himself when he desires to end his pastimes. Thus, Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan and is situated eternally in his original two-handed form. Thus, those well-expressed statements of Devaki concerning the Lord's appearance and disappearance, seeming to indicate that he has a material body, should be seen with another meaning. Though four-armed and two-armed forms are both objects of meditation and therefore eternal, Devaki prayed for him to hide the four-armed form since everyone would know about his appearance. Since that form was famous as the Lord, she feared what Kamsa would do. Janmate maya sao papo ma vidyan madhusudana samud dvije bhavadheto kamsad aham adhir dihi. O killer of Madhu, sinful Kamsa should not know that you have been born to me. With mind unsteady because of your mercy, I fear that Kamsa will... With mind unsteady because of your mercy, I fear what Kamsa will do to you. So meaning that our mind's unsteady is Krishna's mercy, or we're talking about Kamsa's unsteady mind, or... I always say, if something doesn't seem to read well, or it doesn't, the point's not clear, always go back to Prabhupada's, like that, because he brings out he gives the actual literal translation. This is a literal translation. You can't understand what's going on. Prabhupada brings out what actually is there. Does that make sense? She also felt she would be ridiculed by people with material vision who were ignorant of the Lord's Sarup Shaktis, which caused his birth and other pastimes. Okay. As Mahavishnu, you support the universe which appears in your body after Brahma's night. You have also appeared in my womb. Oh, people will ridicule me for this. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.3.31.
It's because of your appearance, Maharaj. It's not because of your mercy.
Okay.
With unsteady mind, mind unsteady because of your appearance. Because she's appeared, then she's anxious to protect him.
Yes, but I'm just saying that's the thing, is that you have to know the context, what's there, because see, it's just like if I say, you know, yeah, he's a nice guy, you know, but we should consider maybe, you know, how, what he should do, you know, if he should be doing this work or maybe not, or, okay, direct words, what am I saying, right? I'm saying... You know, I mean, if you just take the words literally, I'm saying, yeah, he's a nice guy and this work is here and we should consider if he's the guy to do the work. But if you know the context of what I'm saying it and how the language is used, what was I saying? I'm completely doubting if the guy should be doing the work. You understand? That's the importance of the acharyas and their commentaries and how they, like that. Otherwise, you won't know. Because we have, like it said, the demons, they can't see spirit, you know. And we ourselves also, we can't see spirit because of our mentality being disconnected from the Lord. So the Lord then, through his potency, his internal potency, appears through the external, you know, through the medium of the external energy so we can see him. Because it's him anyway. It's just an extension of extensions. But just he himself personally comes there. You know, it's just like, let's say, he sits in his office, you know, and those who know the place and they're running can see the, you know, the person or proprietor everywhere and how he's running things, how he's doing things. They can see, you know, his mood and what he things are there, why it's like the way it is. But others can't. And so if they're not catching it, he can come down and just stand there in front of them and say, okay, you know, what's the problem, what's this and that, and then work it out for them. Does that make sense? So the Dham and that, that's why it looks, there was an original article, I think, in BTG, would have been Not sure, it would have been quite early. That first time, I think it would have been 72 or something, when Prabhupada went to Vrindavan, took so many devotees, they did that Nectar Devotion seminar there at
Oh, that's 1970.
Oh, that early, okay. So that time when he went there and they're going, then Hayagriva, then he's giving the scenario, you know, it's like, what do you call it, the opening the Gita, setting the scene. So he's setting the scene. He's talking about the pigs and the drains and the dirt and this and that and all that, and then there are ideas from that, but then from out of that, then we get this glorious, Prabhupada just says, no, why are you doing like that? That's because of your mundane vision. You're seeing that. You know, that's on the side. You know, these are devotees that just didn't quite get it together, so they're pigs. Why you'd focus on them being pigs? Why not focus on the glory of the Dham? You know, and the glory of the Dham, that even though they've made mistakes, they become pigs, they're still in the Dham. They're still Krishna's pigs. You know, they're not out in, you know, how you say, Nebraska somewhere running around. You know, so that kind of thing is that, that's what's essential, is that that's what we're trying to bring out. That's the actual meaning that is there. So what happens is, you know, one may say, well, that's hard to see. That's not the direct or the literal meaning. Notice that is the literal meaning, just that we're not so, we don't understand the context. And we're so much, how you say, founded in lexicography. Not how you said it. Lexicography means dictionaries. Does that make sense? Because when we're dealing with the Sanskrit, we're looking at a dictionary. And that dictionary is going to be according to one materialistic German, how what he thought was the way the words are used. How he'd use them. From his perspective. Right? Not from what's the perspective of how they're used in the Vedic literature. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then, because of their dependence on that, that makes it difficult. That's why then Prabhupada's word for word is there, so you can see what is there. And then, if you have that, you look, there are sentiments. It's there. The root is there. You want to take it down to that? You can. And then see how it came out and you got this one instead of that one. Does that make sense? Because that's always one of the difficulties. How you know someone who's a native speaker of a language and someone who's not is how they use the synonyms.
It's
you know?
Always studied school in Soviet Union. Because what they did, first of all, it's British English, more or less, not American.
Right.
And it's a very old idioms and synonyms. You know, nobody speaks like this.
Yes, yes.
When you go to speaking English-speaking areas or people, they couldn't understand what you mean because the meaning of the word is not useful anymore, or it's just the opposite. You know,
yeah, it's in the wrong position. Or only if someone was, let's say, a literature, you know, like a PhD in literature and that, then they might appreciate that you're speaking, you know, this older.
And also in Russian, it's when you say you have to do it, it has one meaning. And we always used to learn must do it, you know, so it sounded so really army style.
Yeah, yeah,
like order.
we always giving orders.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just, and there's always so many words that are the same thing, but they can be taken in different ways. Yes. So that's the thing. What I'm saying is that's why, unless one follows in the footsteps of the acharyas, it won't work out. You know. So that's always the thing. So then sometimes it come up. So in here is that, you know, it may come up. So we just have to look back at, you know, what is Prabhupada's translation and what's the different word. Then you understand what's going on. And either reword this or just use Prabhupada's. You know, so it's simple. Because in here, basically, we only run across it very, very rarely. You know, very, very rarely. Because the person who does this does a very good job. You know, they're very careful about these things because they have much more understanding. But then sometimes there's these subtleties that are being that might be missed. So that's why then one can check. But the comment before was on people who are thinking that, yeah, Prabhupada is there, it's nice, but then there's a direct meaning, not direct or a literal meaning, like that. That's not correct.
Well, the difficulty, as far as I understand, with the Bhagavatam also, that the scripture itself uses maximum amount of styles. And the Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, he mentions that because he studies Sanskrit and, you know, he's interested in that area, poetry and prose.
Yes.
So he said it's 30 styles used in Bhagavatam. And because Shukadeva Goswami was going into, you know, different moods, he changes styles like from one verse to another. Mm-hmm. And then if you don't know, you know, how the Baba develops, you don't understand why you know, what's going on, what is the meaning, you know, why, who's doing this, is it the same? So it's very, it's the Bhagavatam is, it amongst all the scriptures, it's the most developed and in terms of poetry, so it's very difficult
to
carry the mood, not just to translate it.
Yes. That's the, it means Vyasadeva wrote this in his maturity.
Yeah.
Because it was the last thing. It means in the way of meters, there's over 500 meters used. We just think that there's a few, but actually the subtleties between where the long and short is actually changes with the meter. So sometimes in one verse, it'll all be 1 meter. Sometimes, you know, the first half will be 1 meter, the second half will be another. Sometimes all four lines, all portas will be different meters, or any combination. So, yes, you get that. You know, it's just like if we're telling something, and we're telling some story, let's say if it's more active, we'll use certain words and moods and all that. But let's say we're talking about something, you know, let's say, you know, the mother's dealing with the child, we'll use different words. You know, you're talking about a romantic couple, you use different words again. So it's just, you're dealing with the best poets there are. You know, you have Vyasadeva, who's originally composed it. Then his son, you know, is no less qualified than speaking it. Then Sutta, because, you know, in his line, then they're all of the Puranas are there. So he'll naturally, according to the flavor that's there, bring it out and all that. And then documented by Vyasadeva again. So you're dealing with the topmost poets. So it's naturally going to be very, very special. So that should always be remembered. And it should never be doubted, you know, Prabhupada and the Acharyas at their level. You know what I'm saying? Because for them, this is their language. Yeah. She also thought that he should not be the object of meditation for others and appear in a hidden manner, right? So, because if they think about him, then there may be trouble. If they don't think about him, so she wanted to hide in that way.
Demons?
Yeah, because the demons, because Kamsa, he's meditating on Vishnu, but he's making trouble every day. He's creating a problem. So if he stops thinking about Krishna, then there'll be less problem, you know. You Pandavas are most fortunate in this world. Sages who purify the planets come to your houses because the Supreme Brahman personally resides in your houses in a human form secretly. Meditation on both forms is described in Gopal Tapati Upanishad. Maturayam viseshena mam dhyayan moksham ashnate ashtapatram vikasitam Harita Padma Tatra Samstitam Chatur Bhujam Shankha Chakra Sharanga Padma Gadan Vitam. Meditating on me in Mathura with attention, one quickly becomes free from obstacles to attaining me. One should constantly meditate on me, situated in Mathura, situated on an 8-petaled lotus in the heart, endowed with four arms holding conch, chakra, bow, lotus, and club. Gopaltapa in Upanishad 2:57-59. Finally, it says, Jayen manasi mam nityam venu shringa dharam tuva. Or one should meditate on me, offering fearlessness to my devotees, holding a flute and horn. Gopaltapani, Upanishad 2:6-1. In the Agamas also, meditation on the two-handed form is described. Therefore, in order to hide, Krishna should show two hands, since it is more secret. With that intent, Krishna says, I have shown you this form so you will remember my previous appearances before you. You would not understand my birth if I appeared in my human-like form. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.3.44. Right? So, because they prayed that he would come as their son, and they were praying to the Lord, therefore he appeared in that form, the foreign form, just so they would be convinced, yes, the Lord came as their son. Because if he came in the two-arm, they may or may not appreciate. So he's just showing for them. Because the two-arm form, then, being the highest, it's beyond what most people would know. Right? Only those who would be coming in the parampara and hearing from authorities would know about the two-arm form. Otherwise, you see from the scriptures on that, the four-arm form is generally what's talked about. And so most all the devotees are dealing with that four-arm form. And then some deal also with the two-arm, but it's kind of like a feature of the forearm. Like you see when he walks into Mathura, then he has four arms. But then at other times, you see he has two arms. You know, so for them, it's kind of like the forearm because he's God, but he has two arms because it's human-like pastime. So it's you know, it becomes nice. Like I see a deity in South, I can't remember the temple, but it's Rukmini Dwarkadish. And he's standing there with holding a flute, playing a flute. But he has four arms. So two hands are playing the flute and the other two hands have, you know, shaka chaka. You seen that deity?
I think I remember Behemoth or some deity name.
Yeah, sounds like that. Maybe somewhere there in either Chennai or Mysore. What's that? Kanchi? I kind of remember. Very nice deity.
What does it mean, this deity?
What we're meaning is that you have this concept with those who are in that Vaikuntha mood, that the two-armed pastimes are just a feature of the Lord who has four arms. So that's why then if he does, he may not know. He may just think it's ordinary. You won't think he's connected. So he shows the forearms, then goes to the two. Because the two-arm form is beyond that. Like I remember we were getting some, very excellent chanters to chant Brahma Samhita. And not sure if we did it. I mean, the one that I'm remembering specifically was with Madhva, because we wanted it not in the regular chanting, but in the Gamakam form, which is like a sung form, but it's sung without music, you know, so it doesn't have a beat and stuff like that. Sometimes you hear it. I don't know if you've, you know what I'm talking about? You know, like let's say in the Brahma Samhita you get that Shriya Kanta Kanta Paramapurusha Kalpa Taravavi. You know, it's there's a style like that, and in the South Indian it sounds a bit more like singing.
Yeah.
Though it's not exactly. So it's something in between chanting and the full singing. So they call that gama. Like that. And so then it was having him to do that. And then, so he starts with the first verse, and, you know, he does some verses. And then afterwards, you know, it was kind of on the side. He wasn't, like, directly talking to us. But he was kind of like himself, just thinking there's something wrong with the grammar of Sanskrit in these verses. Because in the verses, it's pointing out about Krishna's two-armed form, the original, and everything like that. And so his thing is, no, that's not. It's, you know, Mahanarayan is original.
But they're not Brahma-Madhva.
But they only get up to Vaikuntha. They don't, means you have devotees of Krishna and Vrindavan and stuff like that, but it's all part of the just extended Dwarka scene. You know, it's like Vaikuntha, they see like that also. So you do have amongst them who worship like we see of the 12 Alwars. Three had prayers on Radha Krishna in Vrindavan. But it would be part of so many other prayers, except one, Andala, was only on Vrindavan. So they'll the pundits there will joke with us that Andal was ISKCON, you know, like that. So there's they don't have a problem that there's there, but they just think it's expansion. That's why I was saying is that Krishna comes into Mathura, he's got him, Krishna and Balaram on the four arms, and they're, you know, everyone's seeing. But then at other times they have two. You know, when they're interacting, but then they have two. So for them, they're just seeing that back and forth aspect. So here is pointing out that, because if he shows that, not everybody understands that the Supreme Lord has two armed form, that's the highest. So by showing this, then going to that, then she knows, and then he goes into the other form.
It's Venu Gopal Swami.
Huh?
It's Venu Gopal Swami.
Venu Gopal Swami, okay.
Venu Gopal.
And where?
Chennai,
okay. Yeah. Yeah, very famous deity, very beautiful. In Padma Purana, Vyasa says, Pashyatvam darshayishyami swarupam vedagopitam tato pashyam aham bhupa balam kalam buddha prapam gopa kanya vritam gopam Hasantam Gopa Balakai. The Lord said, look, I will show my form hidden in the Vedas. O King, I then saw the young cowherd boy with the complexion of a dark cloud surrounded by gopis, laughing with cowherd boys. Ityuktva Siddharis Tushnim Bhagavan Atma Mayaya Pitro sampashyato sadhyo bhabhuva prakrita shishu. After thus speaking, the Lord remained silent. Thus they alone watched by his mercy. He suddenly assumed the form of a baby, his spiritual form. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.3.46. Yeah. So, Krishna is just a matter of he's expanded, and so in those expansions they have their natural activities and qualities and all that they make. So if it's Vishnu Tattva, it's all him. So if he wants to manifest as two-armed form or as four, it's not a problem for him. Like we see in with Gopa Kumar and Vaikuntha, or in Mathura, then he can manifest his pastimes in Braj. At the same time, we see in Braj, then with the cowherd boys, they have some fun, then he manifests four arms, and Sri Dama becomes Garuda, and they fly around a bit, you know, and everybody has a good laugh, you know? And so because it's all him, that's his sarup is the source of everything. So, and as mentioned before, there was a definition of sarup, I think Jiva Goswami gave, where the sarup means the form, his qualities, his associates, the dham, the pastimes, all that means the sarup. So it doesn't just mean the bodily form, as we generally tend to take it. It means the whole scene. That's how then the Ichashakti is the source of all the associates, the dham, the everything. Because it's from that is there. But we see the mechanics of it. Then it's you have the jnana and the kriya, the sandini and the samvit, then they manifest those features. But they're all part of the internal potency. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like that. Then the Lord remained silent, and by his own desire, Atma Mayaya, showed his baby form. Mahasamhita says, Atma Maya Tadicha Syad, Atma Maya means his will. Prakrita means he appeared in his surup. He was not a material child. Various qualities, such as being a child, reside in the form of the Lord. O unrestricted Lord, O Lord endowed with his powers. In other words, everything's in his surup. He is everything. So his desires, of which things will be manifest. Then, as assistants, then his energies and his expansions manifest those things. So therefore, then Balaram and his Shaktis then arrange these things. Does that make sense? Yeah. Oh, unrestricted Lord. Oh, Lord endowed with all powers. Oh, Supersoul. Oh, Lord spread throughout all time. Who knows where, how many and when your pastimes will take place in the universe. Spreading Yoga Maya, you play. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.14.21. That this is his spiritual form was shown in the explanation of the verse in the Bhagavad Sandarbha. Oh, this verse, okay. That this is his spiritual form was shown in the explanation of this verse in Bhagavad Sandarbha. This is also Ramanuja's meaning of Prakritim Swam Avastabhya Sambhavam Yatmamayaya. Situated in my own nature, Prakritim, I appear by my own knowledge in the form of my will, Atmamayaya. Nigantu says, Maya Vayunam Jnanam. Maya means wisdom or knowledge. Nigantu, I think, is a dictionary. Yeah. So here you see, Maya means wisdom or knowledge. Right? But we can also know it can be, it's wisdom or knowledge, but whether the wisdom is directed towards Krishna or it's directed away. So if it's towards, then it's proper. And if it's away, then that'll be the illusion. So the root, then you can see where it goes. Because otherwise, if we say Maya, you wouldn't think wisdom or knowledge. Does that make sense? That's why then you have these, but then the dictionary, you need to go back to those, what the acharyas use, or like Prabhupada's always quoting Yaska and things like that. These, then the Gantu here, or Amarkosh. Mahabharata also says that the avatar forms are not material. Nabhuta sanga samsthano dehosya paramatmanaha. The body of the Lord is not made of material elements. Vishnu Purana says.
This is about the dictionary. Hmm. This is the difference between Uta and Amarkosh.
Means those will all have a good thing. What I'm talking, why I'm making the big distinction is Monier Williams.
Those are like
what's called? Well, Yaska is a Vedic dictionary, Vedic Sanskrit. So if you don't understand Vedic grammar, it won't mean anything to you. So the Prabhupada was using it means he understood that. Otherwise, how did he translate the Upanishad? Because generally, I've seen as others. Who are very, good, we would consider them very good in our society. Anywhere for translating Sanskrit, they have trouble translating Vedic Sanskrit. It just doesn't make sense to them. Because of they always use very obscure words, the Vedas. That's why it appears in one way. It says, Indra is saying, worship me, but what he's saying is, I am Indra because of the potency of the Lord. So what is Indra is the Lord. Worship that Indra. That's what he's saying. But otherwise you may take it that he's meaning him as the demigod. Amarkosh is giving, I think it has different sections, it's one section is just synonyms. It's just giving, a word, and then what are all the synonyms of it? And they're standard. There's, this word has 10, this word has 12, this word has...
Oxford Dictionary, kind of?
It would be more like a thesaurus. You know, if thesauruses give, you know, the alternative kind of ways of using the word and what else, you know, the other context. Because you have a word, a root, and that will come out as a word. Then you have, from that, what are all the different connections? You know, like that, depending upon how it's applied. So then you have to get the right word for there. So I think, from what I understand, the thesaurus basically is all based on synonyms. And that, and so it's harder to put together. Means the other one, you just alphabetically put the words in the dictionary, and then you deal as best you can. And these ones, they deal with they may put a word, but the synonyms aren't alphabetical. You may have the main words you're going to use in the thesaurus, but then from there they go out and they'll say, you know, look at this page, look at that page. So you have the thesaurus, all the different words, and then in the back there may be a glossary that gives what you're looking for and where to find it, what page. Because otherwise you don't necessarily know. That's the whole idea of the thesaurus, is you don't, you have an idea of a word. Because, in other words, the aspect of nod is there. You can get a concept of it, but it doesn't form enough to turn into either an action or into, you know, the energy of it, the action of it, or the noun. So you can't say what it is, right? Because that's the transformations it goes through. So you only kind of get that, you know, you have an idea, suddenly the nod aspect is there. So then those, that deals. Yaska, I'm not, oh no, I mentioned Yaska. Nirupta, I think that's also Vedic. Yeah. And that, and this, what was that, Nigantu?
Nigantu.
I'm not sure about that.
Maharaj, Nigantu here, it says, Nigantu is the original compilation done by the sages. Nigantu and Nirupta is become famous after Yaska compiled.
So then he's compiled those into his form.
Yes, yes.
Okay, because his dictionary, it's like every word can be gleaned from it, but it's only 100 pages long. So that's the whole point. If you're using, I mean, so like English, like the Oxford Dictionary is so big, you know, because it's giving every option there is. But these Vedic, especially that, then that Vayaska, Nigantu, and Nirupta, they're giving, you start with the root and then where it can go from. They're starting with what people have done with it. So there's unlimited, you know, words. It's just like their roots, there's only 2,000 roots of words. Of that, 1,200 are generally used. And even when discussing, let's say, Old English, I can't say about other, but Old English, it's not very many words. But because people know the grammar in that, they take it and then create all the words they need to do. Because if you add on, you know, it's like in English you don't really have it. It becomes a phrase. But in most languages you have a word. And if you're talking about coming from, you add, you know, a certain, you know, something on the front, back, or middle. If he's going somewhere, you put a different one. If it belongs to him, you put a different one. You know, does that make sense? Yeah. Yes, so basically what it is, these Vedic, instead of dealing with that word, they go back to the root, and then by that you know how to build. So that means to be able to use those, you have to know the grammar and everything like that, then you can appreciate them. But it means then you can't just look up the word. You have to go back and they'll show you the path that it's going through, and then you can see where it's gotten to, what it is, and therefore then what it means. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's interesting that I didn't know that many details, not any of the details, but the difference in the system, it's very obvious. One system makes you think.
Yes.
And use your brain.
Yes.
Gives you the principal knowledge.
Right.
And then you can develop it basically unlimited if you know how to deal with it.
Yes.
The other, it just gives you end result. And say, okay, that's what it is, use it. But then you have to memorize or know all those things.
Yeah. No, it becomes very big. becomes very, very big. And then the problem is in usage, because that means if someone actually, that means it would be a fun study if someone actually knew, you know, properly. I'm just thinking in English, because other languages already have it. What is the word? I mean, how the grammar works and how it's applied. Then you can take these basic kind of, maybe not completely root, but more common, generally used kind of words, and then take them and put them into all the forms. Because the funny thing in English, only some of the forms are used. So some of them are used as declined and some of them are used as phrases. So occasionally, then you say something and people will say, it's not a word. But according to grammar, it is a word. It's just people don't use it. You know? Does that make sense? You know, it's like you have a word and then you have like so many forms of how it can be, you know, and so as a kid you're having to learn all that. So it's the same thing. It's just there's grammar, it's applied, but it's just not applied nowadays. So that's why then, especially going into English, it becomes difficult, because then, you know, the Sanskrit works on a different way. Then you put it into English and you have to know how that's going to be. And so then as we see Jiva Goswami, as pointed out by some Sri Vaishnava scholars, is how he writes, you can't twist the meaning. You just can't. It doesn't matter what you do grammatically to it, you know, like the Mayavada, you can't do it. Like, you never see them dealing with this, because you can't twist it. And so they read it because they're so amazed. You know, for them, you know, it's like they're Shakespeare, you know, or something like that. It's just so far out, you know, the language like that. So you have that. And so we see the Srila Prabhupada, they're very careful about what word he picks. Otherwise, yeah, you can just translate it. But sometimes you sit there a long time to get the right word, because there's so many synonyms, but any of the other synonyms, you may get the wrong idea. But, and they may work really well, but you get the wrong idea. But this word, you can't get the wrong idea. You may not get the idea, but you won't get the wrong idea. So better no idea than wrong idea, because then the right idea you can get by association with the Vaishnavas. But once you have the wrong idea, then that's really, you know, you need a crowbar or a hammer or, you know, a stick of dynamite to get rid of.
Yes, Nigvantu is the original one, which has three khandas, three aspects. It is Nigvantu itself means the collection of words, and also it has the whatever way you are using the science, how you collect, and all it's all together called Nigvantu, the main dictionary. Nirukta means then Yaska especially is the science of usage. So he explains basically in detail that how these words are used and why are they used and they are obscure.
Okay, so based on Nigvantu.
Yeah. So out of the three khandas, the first khanda was explained in detail in Nirukta, and the second, third, and explain a little bit, because the third one is how the demigods use.
That's also going to be, that's another thing that's not a, maybe not known. He says there's 30 different styles, but there's eight actual grammars of Sanskrit. Like that. So, means what we use is Narayan's. Like that. Patanjali is Shiva's. Brahma has his. Indra has his. Yama has his. I think Varuna has. It means all the Digpals and like that. There's eight. And that's Sanskrit, so we're not even talking here, you know, Prakrit, you know, the Paisach and all those things. So that's also, so when you see Brahma, he's generally always talking in, it means his verses are always a 14 syllable, like that. So that's in his grammar. So it means from one, you'll understand it, that's why there's that different flavor and everything, how they like to put it together. It's correct, but it'll have a certain flavor. So it'll be going, so if he's talking about the particular person, whatever he speaks or his line, it'll be in that style. So you'll have that also, and then within that maybe you have the varieties according to the, so it's whatever there is in language, it's in Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, also the second aspect is dealing with homonyms, you said.
Who?
In Nigantu, the second khanda, it deals with homonyms. Homonyms means they have the same spelling but different meaning,
mm-hmm.
or same meaning but different spelling, those kind of.
Okay.
Basically dealing with the ambiguous words itself.
Okay.
And in, because then to poetry and all, it is needed the most.
Yes.
That they use more.
Yes, why they use it? Poetry means you're working within a meter, and you've written something that you really, really like and it works, but now you have a word to put at the end, you need two syllables, but the word you are planning to use has three. So either you adjust other things, or you find that synonym, or that other, you know, whatever it is, that only has two. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, or let's say you're using a particular meter that in this place, if you want to put the word there, the second syllable has to be long, not the first. So you have to use another word that has the meaning that will be like that. So poetry is quite elaborate. You know, because in English you just have to get the last syllable basically to match. But here it's like it's all the way through and like that. Yes, go ahead, please continue.
So basically it seems that Nirupta Yaska describe the whole science and give only a few examples. And Nigantu would have everything,
yes.
Whatever it is.
Okay, so then exists. Between the two, then you actually understand.
And Amarakosha is not related?
Amarakosha is just explaining some aspect of Nigantu.
Yeah, I think it also has a lot to do with poetry. You know, like 10 different names of an Ashwata tree or something like that, or 12 names of a sun, or you know, things like that. So it'll have areas like that, and it'll also give definitions, because you'll see Amarakosha has definitions, it has synonyms, and I can't remember what the last one is.
And
Monier
Williams, can you say that what he did is just the normal dictionary?
Yeah, just the normal dictionary. It's just how it's like that, and they'll put it together, and it'll be from his perspective. You know, he is German, he is Westerner, he is a Christian. They're impressed with, you know, it's earlier, they're impressed with the Vedic culture, that maybe they all come from there. But at the same time, it'll be limited, because unless you're a devotee, it'll be harder to understand a lot of these things like that. So that wasn't written from the idea of trying to destroy the culture like Max Müller's stuff is. You know, in other words, if people have faith in the culture and you can't deviate them from that. So, might make a translation that throws some doubt on that, understanding the way you're saying, then you dislodge them from there. Like that. So that's what they did. The British, that was the plan. So then they did that and then trained the, you know, the aristocratic Indians, because you can't teach everybody this. I say, you know, in one city there's more people than the whole country of England, right? You know, so they can't do that. So they would just catch them, because catching them, they lead the society, they'll adjust everyone else. So they did adjust them from that and had them think more Western. And so they thought, now we'll be able to control them. But they didn't understand the power of the culture and the individuals. So therefore, yes, you dislodge them a bit from the Vedic, you know, to be very authentic. And where they had a little bit more of a world view, but in the world view, who likes being a slave? Right? I mean, that's the song, right? You know, I said, oh, Britannia rules the waves. I never have... something. Whatever. They won't be slaves. That's the song. And so then these guys, they learned that. So why should they be slaves? So then they started in the mid-1800s, or earlier, I think the 1830s, they started the Swaraj. It took 100 years, but they got them out. So that was a case of, if they had left well enough alone, they would have been Hindus, they would have been doing their own life and everything, and they would have still be the richest country in the world, England. But because they decided, no, we got to get at more, then they lost everything. So they're idiots.
So French and Mauritius,
yeah,
still there.
Mm-hmm.
They're still there, and the richest ones.
Yeah. So that's the whole thing, is that you just, they have that culture, you leave them there, you do that, you just control them and take the money, then they would have been fine. You know? But they couldn't do that. And then they start to exploit, you know, like that, you know, you're fair, it would just go on forever. But they have to exploit, they have to do, they have to this, that, they have to be proud, you know, all these things, and then it just develops to a point where, you know, who's going to tolerate? You know? So if you got kicked out of India, the most tolerant people in the world, then you know you're a problem. You know your attitude's bad.
I think in this case, the being too much personal, that what actually, you know, because they got into the culture which was personal to the Hindus. If they kept it impersonal, they wouldn't be a problem as much. But it became personal, so that's that. But it looked,
yeah,
at least,
I mean, the Mughals ran the place for how many?
900 years.
Yeah, and they weren't trying to get liberation from them. You know, so that's the thing, is that you just, you know, you have to be somewhat smart. Not saying it's good, but the point is in the Vedic system, you're always going to have kings above kings above kings, and then you have the emperor. So the point is you let the kings run their kingdom properly, as long as they're not doing something stupid. You know, if the people are exploited or that, then a bigger king will come in and correct it. But otherwise, management, you manage, you administrate, and it works nicely and everybody's prosperous. When you try to exploit too much or try to control too much or change the value, then it's not your business. You know, it's just like, what do you call it? Chakwadi, his family. They're the kings of Gandhar, right? They're not changing the people. They're just seeing that they don't kill each other. Right?
Which is hard.
Yeah, now those kings aren't there, and now they're killing each other. Right? Yeah. You know? Or what's his name? Nala. He was the king of the Nishadas. Nishadas are Nishadas. They do their Nishada stuff. You know?
One scholar is describing that in Amarakosh deals with only nominal words. It's where noun is the main thing.
Okay.
But Nigantu has both nominal and verbal.
Verbal, okay. Yeah, no, because it's more about talking, like I said, trees, this, that.
So basically Nigantu deals with the whole Vedic and non-Vedic, and Vedic and classical.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, classical is derived from Vedic,
yeah,
but it's okay.
And then Amarakosh mainly deals with classical.
Yes. Yeah, it's more about the poetry. You're looking for what words to use, or it is poetry, so you're looking to know, you know, what is that tree that they're talking about there. It lists all the trees, then you know, okay, it's these, it's this. So, you know, it's just like, you know, in the verse it comes about, the village lion. What's a village lion? You know. Hmm? No, the dog. You know, because lions are famous for roaring and, you know, like that, establishing their territory. So in the village, the dog's the village lion. It's used in Bhagavatam. Sutta Goswami uses it. The village lion. Yeah, so those kind of things. Yeah, so depending on what you want, then it's there, and then the different acharyas. So, and then you have ones that are dealing in grammar, so then they'll go back to that. You know, like they'll say, you know, he'll use Patanjali. Grammar he's using is Narayan's grammar. But, you know, people know that, and so then he's using that to establish the different things. Patanjali's given things that people know, you know, that they're known sayings, so then you refer to them, then people know what you're talking about. Then, What's the other? You have in logic, you have Tarka Sangraha. It's a definition, I think, of 100 words. And if you know that, then you can actually properly discuss with people who are using you know, the Gotama's Nyaya and like that, the logic and the words that are meant. Because it gives a specific what it means, but it's generic. It's not according to a philosophy. It's just the generic meaning of the word. And everybody accepts that. Right? And so that way you have a basic, because if everybody didn't, you wouldn't have anything, any way to discuss. So those 100 words, those are foundational that you want to discuss logically. This is how the words are used. And so then you have these different groups of things, you know, and that, and then with that, then it goes together. So does that make sense? So because it's not taking it back so much, or you're not seeing how it connects, you're not seeing the passage, then there may be a mistake in what's made. Hence, then they'll say, "Oh, we're being literal." But being literal is Moni or Wilms is not the definition of literal. You know, that's the whole point. Okay. Vishnu Purana says, okay, that's what we're just turning the page. He who thinks the body of Krishna is material should be excluded from all Shrauta and Smriti actions. If one sees his face, one should bathe with one's clothing on. One should gaze at the sun, touch a cow, and sip ghee for purification. No. It's just ghee for sip. This is not means you're not killing yourself here. You're just purifying yourself. Because ghee is pure, so it means it's just a little ghee, just like that. It's not a lot of ghee.
Butter?
Huh?
Leaf butter.
Yeah.
Olive oil.
Yeah, touch a cow, gaze at the sun, doesn't mean you lot. You just look like that. It's just that moment. It's not a problem, it's just a purified. Because whatever is in the mind, let's say you've seen somebody like that, then they'll be in the mind. If you look at the sun like that, they're gone. That's the whole idea. So you remove them from, like you see a Maya body, then you look at the sun, then you take bath with all your clothes on, you touch a cow, you sip some ghee. You're good. You're purified.
Also, it has an effect, like when you see a person, then the image of them goes in the mind, and then the Hayato Vishyam.
Yes.
So the whole thing, then sun purifies, sun is the purifying agent for vision.
Yes.
And this is for mouth purifying.
Yeah. So it's just, there's also ghee has a purifying effect on the body. It uplifts the body and all that. It raises that. Oil doesn't. Oil isn't as good like that. It means it's good. It does so many different things in health and that. But it doesn't bring out all these sattvic aspects as much. It just makes it work. Your elbows work and stuff like that.
More taste. If you want more taste,
panchamrita
together, you can do
it. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes, and ski's the essence, then that's... One should consider, and that was from Vishnu Purana. One should consider the meaning of the following verse in view of what was discussed. Regarding both burdens equally, the Lord separated himself from that portion of the Yadus by which he removed the burden of the earth, like removing a thorn with another thorn, Srimad Bhagavatam 1.15.34. Tana or body means the attitude of wanting to remove the burden of the earth and to protect the devatas instead of meeting a material body. Right? So when he says he removed himself, separated himself, it doesn't mean the body. It just means he gives up that aspect that he comes to remove the burden of the earth, right? And to protect the devatas. You have those two. Similarly, in the third canto, 20th chapter, Brahma is described as giving up various mental attitudes, which are called bodies. So that particular He comes with that, you know, it's just like you have a particular mood, and then, like, accordingly, then you will act. You know, you may change your dress to match that, and then your activities will be to accomplish that and everything. Does that make sense? You know. So he's saying he gives that up, that. The example of the thorns is appropriate, since those bhavas, like thorns, were shadow representations of the Lord. The two purposes were the same to the Lord. Similarly, he gave up the bhavas of Matsya and other avatars, as explained in the next verse. Just as the Lord maintains forms such as Matsya and then gives up their bhavas, and just as a magician makes a show of giving up his body, the Lord gave up his bhavas, by which he relieved the burden of the earth. Srimad Bhagavatam 1:15-35. Udriti Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is neither impersonal nor formless, but his body is non-different from him, and therefore is known as the embodiment of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. In the Brihad Vaishnava Tantra, it is clearly mentioned that anyone who considers the form of Lord Krishna to be made of material energy must be ostracized by all means. And if by chance the face of such an infidel is seen, one must clean himself by jumping in the river with his clothing. Yes, yeah, so even in the beginning of Manu, then someone who doesn't believe in the Vedic you know, version, the Vedic culture and all that, you know, or the religion, as is mentioned there, the Dharma Shastra is going to explain, then it's said that such a person you shouldn't spend any time with. It means that, you know, social formalities, if you bump into him, you know, hi, hello, or you have to work with him, you discuss like that. But you will never get into, you know, be close with them, you know, socially, you know, have that intimacy, or, you know, bring them around the family, or marry into their family, or out like this and that kind of thing. You just ignore them like that. Because they don't, so what do they have to do with you? You know, unless there's something that you have to interact, otherwise you wouldn't. So, that makes sense. So it's the same principles that if they think that the Lord's form is material, then why would we get involved with them? You know, because it's just too contaminating, like that. And as preachers, then the fourth category of discrimination is those who are atheists, and they're avoided. Because you can spend your time with them, but they won't be convinced. Right? Does that make sense? Because we're talking about Madhyamas. Now, if someone is an Uttama, they may be able to adjust them. You know, just like you see Narad Muni with Magrari the hunter. But unless you're an Uttama Bhakti, you can't do that. As in Madhyama, you make the discrimination because you're not dealing with that. It doesn't mean you're not pleasant and nice and all that, but it just means that you don't get into those things with them. They come up to you and say hello and start to talk, and where are you from? You just talk. You don't get in. As soon as you see that discussing about Krishna, the philosophy of the holy name, they're not interested at all. You just don't bring it up. You know, so it's just exchange of pleasantries and things like that, but you don't get into preaching. But if you see they're innocent or they're interested, then you'll take it somewhere. And if by chance the face of such an infidel is seen, one must clean himself by jumping in the river with his clothing. The Lord is described as Amrita, or deathless, because he has no material body. Under the circumstances, the Lord's dying or quitting his body is like the jugglery of a magician. The magician shows by his tricks that he is cut into pieces, burnt to ashes, or made unconscious by hypnotic influences. But all are false shows only. Factually, the magician himself is neither burnt to ashes nor cut to pieces, nor is dead or unconscious at any stage of his magical demonstration. Similarly, the Lord has his eternal forms of unlimited variety, of which the fish incarnation, as was exhibited within this universe, is also one. Because there are innumerable universes, somewhere or other the fish incarnation must be manifesting his pastimes without cessation. In this verse, the particular word datte, eternally accepted, and not the word ditva, accepted for the occasion, is used. The idea is that the Lord does not create the fish incarnation. He eternally has such a form. and the appearance and disappearance of such an incarnation serves particular purposes. In the Bhagavad Gita 7:24-25, the Lord says, quote, "The impersonalists think that I have no form, that I am formless, but that at present I have accepted a form to serve a purpose, and now I am manifested." Right. So the word dipva, accepted for the occasion. So you see this, that I have accepted a form to serve a purpose. This has been brought up many times already. So this is what it's referring to. It says, you know, Brahman has accepted a form due to a purpose, but actually Brahman has no form. That's their idea. So, but no, the form is always there. Yes?
Just to clarify on this point, we learned previously that the Vaikuntha Lokas, they are Chaturbhuj Narayan forms.
Mm-hmm.
But here it is mentioned, for example, that the Matsya form, it eternally exists, but it exists in one of the many material universes.
Yes,
that's the form. Otherwise, what's referred to Matsya in Vaikuntha is Narayan form. Is that correct?
Yes. He'll have the conch, club, disc, and lotus. The order of them will give that definition.
Right.
And then there's a specific mood that's there and how it's like. So that will be brought up. So devotees that are attracted by that, then they will be dealing with that form. And they'll be happy. So yes, because it's also important to understand is that, you know, which will probably come up as we go, then there is no as such material world that is a separate place. We take it as a separate place that nothing from there can be here, nothing from here can be there. But it's just like within the state, then they have a prison for criminals. It's still part of the state. It's still the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
And those who are not criminals move in and out of that as they would move in and out in outside the prison. And their duties and all that are in connection with outside the prison. But, you know, in the context of the prisoners. So that's the whole thing. So for the prisoners, it's prison. But for the workers of the state, it's not prison. It's a place where those who are conditioned stay, but it's not. So that's the whole thing. Prabhupada mentions for the Uttamadhikara, there is no material world. It's all Krishna's kingdom. So they're always seeing in that way. So this is then where those pastimes are going.
Yeah. So it's like a playground.
It's a playground. It's just another playground.
Yeah.
You know, the spiritual world has certain aspects of the playground, and here has other aspects. So there it's all based on the pure love of the devotees, and here it's then interacting with the pure love of the devotees in the context of all those around who are not necessarily dealing in pure love. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So then it takes on that. Otherwise, then it's not about how can you say it's this and that and all. So it's just like the pastimes with Arjuna, you know, and Narayana and Rishi and all, that's happening here. Prabhupada says he's eternally with Krishna in his pastimes within the Mahatattva.
Yeah.
So all these happen here, not there, Goloka. There'll be something that's going on there. But all these, just like the Vaikuntha deity, Nrisimhadeva, is there. But where, you know, he breaks out of a pillar and rips Hiranyakashipu in half, that happens here. It doesn't happen there.
Yeah.
You know, so Hiranyakashipu is there in that he's a servant of the Lord. But, you know, with Prahlad Maharaj and that there. And then here they have the pastimes they're doing here. So, yeah. Yeah. In the verse, the particular word datte, eternally accepted, and not the word ditva, accepted for the occasion, is used. The idea is that the Lord does not create the fish incarnation. He eternally has such a form, and the appearance and disappearance of an incarnation serves particular purposes. So, they're thinking, for the occasion, he accepts it, but it's material. But here, you will be able to appreciate seeing or not seeing according to the particular purpose. Does that make sense? So that's the thing, is they almost have it, but not quite. And that not quite is enough that if you see them, you need to go take a bath. In the Bhagavad Gita 7:24-25, the Lord says, "The impersonalists think I have no form, that I am formless, but that at present I have accepted a form to serve a purpose, and now I am manifested. But such speculators are factually without sharp intelligence. Although they may be good scholars in the Vedic literatures, they are practically ignorant of my inconceivable energies and my eternal forms of personality." Right? So they have intelligence, but it's not sharp. Does that make sense? They can't see beyond. Just like we see, it's a standard kind of, I don't know about in other parts of the world, but at least for America, is that the professor, the absent-minded professor, he's so absorbed in thinking about his, you know, whatever it is, that you know, he forgets to dress properly or doesn't show up on time because he got into something or... It's everywhere, yeah. So it's a universal. Just to make sure, just in case. And just in case in your place they did do that, but no one talks about it, and so it's an offensive thing to spring up, so just to make sure. Yeah, so like that, is they can't function outside of the circle of their what they know. That's why it's not sharp intelligence. They're intelligent, maybe very, but they can't, where they apply it. So they're only applying it in one area. Like you say you have an IQ. The IQ is basically seeing, can you tell the difference between things and what's common between things and to what degree? Right? Now, then someone has this high IQ, but then the problem is they only apply it in a specific area. They can't see outside that. They absolutely can't see. So then that becomes the thing. So they're without sharp intelligence. So they're very good at their speculation in the area that they work, but they can't see beyond that. So that's the weakness. But they will think, because I'm so smart, I could know anything. And possibly, yes, with that intelligence, mechanical, they could, but because of their nature and karma and conditioning, they can't. Yes.
Also, as we discussed before, that with that intelligence, there is no emotion involved, then it will never become a realization.
Okay.
So then, we may have that intelligence, but if it's not a realization, it cannot be of use to anybody.
Yeah, because you have to personally apply it.
Yes.
That's a good point.
When he is a master, he has already reached to that higher level because of which he can apply it and help anybody applying in their own life.
Okay, very good. So then that brings down to these scholars, who's master, who's expert. Because you could be the most expert of anybody, but it doesn't mean you actually have mastery. Is that mean?
Yeah.
Like how you say, there is, and the master may or may not be expert. Like I've come across it a few times in the music world, the Indian classical music, where they'll talk about someone. He's an excellent teacher, but not a player. But he's able to teach the person so they can come to the level where they can play how they play. Or like you see, let's say, in Olympics, sports.
Yeah, sports.
The guy can point out to you how to do it,
yeah.
So you learn it. You don't know how it works, and you possibly can't explain it to anybody else, but you can do it. And so you may be the best in the sport, but this guy's actually the master, and you're the expert.
Yeah.
Much of the time you see is... masters are expert, but you can have where they're not.
Yeah.
In the field of engineering, it always works very differently. The guys who are PhDs, their knowledge is like useless practically. They cannot make even a single car or anything.
Mm.
But those who are actual engineers, means who are working in the company, they think more practically and they can utilize things. And but they are not called scientists, they are called like engineers practically.
Mm. So it depends where the terminal degree is.
And then those who become PhD scholars, they just, like, hardly anyone does anything which is practically usable.
Same in economics.
Yeah.
You never make money.
No. Like the guy who teaches the MBA course, you know, doesn't make money. The guy who organized the MBA course, he's making the money. Yeah.
It's like, I don't know how to say it in English, but it's like a sterile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sterile.
Sterile intelligence.
Yeah.
It's there, but it doesn't do any good to anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to the person, not to humanity, no.
Yeah, yeah. It's just the intellect is mechanically working, but the application of that, neither they can do and neither they will get the benefit. You know. So those kind of individuals, if someone else is able to, practically use, then that's where it comes into general usage. But otherwise, they wouldn't. I mean, there was that thing, it was based on that thing, was it the Beautiful Mind?
Yeah.
That was based on a guy who was, you know, super genius guy, you know, to the point he went nuts. But he was working on this unified theory, and he had come up with something like that. Nobody cared about it, and then I think he went nuts, and then he was in the insane asylum for some time. While he was there, somebody in the economic community looked at it, and they figured out how it would work in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they did that, they made it improved it so much that they were willing to give him a Nobel Prize. And of course, they had to wait till he came out of the insane asylum. And then he thought, when they told him that, you know, what am I getting, what's it for? You know, they said, it's this. And, oh, yeah, so it's this. They said, no, it's used like this for that. That's where you're getting it. You know, because he probably got it in economics or something. I don't know. So then he said, oh, I never thought of that. That it would apply like that, you know. But if you're using unified theory, it should work anywhere, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you want how to brush your teeth, you should be able to use your formulas. You know. Yeah, so, like that, it's limited. That's why the society is complete when you have all four, and everybody has to have their respect and everything. You know, so the Kshatriyas have to respect the Brahmins for the knowledge, but the Brahmins have to respect the Kshatriyas how they can apply it. You know, the Vaishyas have to accept the Brahmins for Kshatriyas, because without them, there is no economic environment. You know, if you have Mad Max, there are no big, corporate programs going on, you know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So therefore, it's only because of that it's going on. You know, you may say, no, but, you know, there's wars going on and, you know, in Africa somewhere, and they're making profit. That's because they're sitting in their place where everybody else is sitting, in a protected environment that they can do this exchange and sell it to that guy. But if they had to live in that environment, there'd be nothing. Right? So that has to be respected. At the same time, as you have to respect their application in the economic field, that they can generate, you know, so much facility. You know, so like this, there has to be that mutual respect between everybody. But yeah, and then there's the hierarchy. Yeah? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.